This is not Galen, but I'm giving you a level anyway, just to simulate what it would be like if I were Galen. Does it really make
I don't know where to go with that, that nonsense.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The House is expected to vote on whether to impeach President Trump this week based on two articles, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Today, we're going to preview what to expect as the vote plays out, whether or not there will be defectors in both parties. We'll also look ahead at what's to come in the Senate. Then we're going to take a closer look at second choices in the Democratic primary. Do they tell us anything about the party and how the dynamics of the race could shift in the months ahead as candidates either drop out or as we get to Iowa? So here with me to discuss all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
Good. I a little scruffy today, been doing a lot of modeling kind of in that last desperate stretch, so I want to go with the look of like overworked Nate.
How much sleep are you on right now?
Today, not a lot. Okay. Not a lot today.
That's very interesting. You know, there's just like, this is weird. There's this passage in the Bible that's about how if you're in the middle of like a fasting period or like a difficult time, you're supposed to take extra care with how you present yourself.
Oh, interesting.
So, well, Nate, you're not doing a biblical modeling.
It could be studied nonchalance, Claire.
That's, yeah.
That's and true. As you can hear also with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
All right, let's begin with impeachment. This is the fourth time in American history that a president is facing articles of impeachment. And from reporting, it looks like the vote is going to take place on Wednesday. So, Claire, will there be defectors on either side? And if so, how many?
So we're recording this on Monday morning, and you're already seeing, I think, you know, this morning, a couple of more moderate Dems kind of saying, yes, I'm voting for impeachment, and here's my reasoning why. You also saw over the weekend one Democrat, Jeff Van Drew, who was a Democrat from a Trump voting district in New Jersey. He decided to become a Republican in part because of impeachment. He was against impeachment. But by and large, I think we're seeing the Democratic caucus kind of fall in line.
Do we have any sense of the numbers? Like, so there's 31 Democrats who come from Trump districts. How many of those do we think are possible defectors?
Well, according to the New York Times, has a whip count of sorts up on their site.
Whip count.
And they have one Democrat as a definite no and 18 Democrats as undecided or unclear. And they didn't get responses from 47 Democrats. But let's use that 18 number, I think, as maybe the upper limit on the number of moderate Democratic defections we might see. If it's anywhere near 18, I think that would be treated as a big setback for Pelosi and Democrats. I don't think it will be near that 18. I think single digits is more likely.
And on the Republican side, I think there are only two Republican representatives who represent districts that Clinton won still at this point after the midterms. Is there any expectation that Republicans will lose some votes?
The Times has a big fat zero under Republicans supporting articles of impeachment. Now, remember, there was a Republican, Justin Amash, who is now an independent, who left the party, kind of the, you know, mirror opposite of Van Drew. He is supporting articles of impeachment. And actually, there are some moderate Democrats who are pushing for Amash to be one of the floor managers for the pro-removal side in the Senate trial. But I think the chances are that there will not be a single Republican defection in the House.
Yeah. For the Democrats who are considering voting against articles of impeachment, what's the political rationale? And do we know from history whether or not breaking with your party on big votes like this actually bodes well for you electorally?
The rationale is that these are in districts where Trump won the election in 2016, and we know that Trump's supporters are actually a bit worse than impeachment, the numbers there for Trump. So therefore, if you're someone who's on the fence about Trump, then you might be in that class of about 5% of people who are like, okay, I don't love the president, but I don't really like this impeachment stuff either. And so they're kind of catering to public opinion in their district. And I think the answer is actually that there is a history of people who buck their party more often, get reelected more often. So despite the conventional wisdom being that, oh, it's all about partisanship and party loyalty and whatever else, and they might be making a fairly rational decision in the short run. At the same time, you have kind of a problem where in the more Democratic defections there are, the more the media narrative gets out of hand. And so it's kind of like an all for one win for all kind of thing. And so the fact that you have Pelosi able to hold her caucus together, plus the underlying facts of the case, I mean, you know, I think it's a, you know, I mean, we'll see how many defections there are.
What do you think that limit is for where the media narrative turns to?
I mean, no one really should give a
lawmakers buck the Democratic leadership and aren't for impeachment.
Well, one should really. I mean, it's not clear how much voters care about the media narrative per se, right? I mean, they have fairly strong opinions about this, and the ones who don't have strong opinions are not watching it and following closely anyway. So I don't know that. I don't know that I really have a prediction about that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think the media has shifted into a very kind of both sides kind of frame now that we've moved away from the kind of fact-finding process to the process over process.
Do you think that holds true across the media, or are you talking specifically about the New York Times article that you commented
on? I'm not just subtweeting the New York Times. I think it's kind of like the natural frame. I mean, look, obviously Trump has presented a lot of challenges for kind of how the media covers the White House in general, covers politics in general. I do think that like the bias toward like the both sides frame is going to be brought out by this process where literally you have like both sides kind of taking turns making comments and presenting witnesses and refuting a story, right? And it is, I don't know, it's a detail-oriented process, right? So the very dramatic storylines that you hear in kind of week one tend to fade into the background a little bit, and the kind of, and also Republicans are deliberately trying to create a messier, noisier process.
Normally when I see a Nate criticizing something tweet, I'm like, oh, come on, Nate, take it easy. But then I actually read that article, and I do think it's representative of a problem the media is having.
Can you say what the article is since we're...
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
The branch widens as Congress nears a partisan impeachment.
Breach.
The branch one.
Keep that in, please.
The breach one. Well, and look, it's not even...
Once more into the branch, my friend.
So this is a New York Times article that was basically laying out, you know, how polarized the parties are on impeachment. And the framing was like, there are two realities on impeachment, the Democratic one and the Republican one. Here's how they're treating these facts. And it didn't really at all get into what the facts actually are. It's not like there's no malice behind this problem. It's just like it's kind of a hard situation. And honestly, we've had moments at 538 where you fall into it, because you have essentially what you have is on substance, on evidence, this is a very clear-cut story, right? On politics, you have a both sides story, right?
Yeah.
You have a two-side story. And then so when you have political reporters covering the substance of it, essentially that's where you get into trouble.
You know, I was texting with one of my favorite Ohio voters who has seen two impeachments in their life, and they were commenting about how odd it is that impeachment has like slipped below the fold, right? It's not, they don't feel like it's getting big coverage, and it is striking because I do think that there is a little bit of a sense, probably from, it's not like the, like obviously the media is covering it, obviously like the political media is covering it, but I think that there is probably a sense of like jadedness that all of us have where we do really recognize the reality, like the cynical reality, which is that I think we might talk a little bit about the shape that the Senate trial is taking and the way that McConnell and the White House are coordinating and how that's making Democrats angry and how they're saying it's unconstitutional against the sense of the process. But it is interesting how much I think the popular narrative of impeachment, which is correct, has taken hold, which is kind of like, well, it's going to happen and he's going to get impeached, but he's not going to get convicted. Let's get on with it. Like, I do think that there is a little bit of sense of performance art, and and I do think some people are weirded out by that, probably people with voters with a longer sense of history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is, I think I was watching some interviews on NBC this weekend when I went to Michigan, and for some reason only talked to Republicans and not also to Democrats, but the Republicans, one of them made a comment that was like, when you record the football game, but then you kind of get tipped off and hear the final score beforehand, then it's not that much fun to watch the game, even though you can, you know. So there is a sense in which, like, number one, the very strong likelihood is that you get, exactly right, you get impeachment in the House and not conviction in the Senate. Number two, in some ways, because the first 7 days of the story were so bad for the White House, this is a case of like, okay, all the key facts were revealed. Maybe the Sondland testimony kind of revised your assumption slightly toward being bad to slightly worse, right? But there's not a lot of new information revealed unless, like, you really need to, like, refine your estimate of kind of what this behavior was to some very fine degree, which I don't think anybody really does, right? Because everyone's either, like, said this is bad enough or it's nowhere near bad enough, and there are not, you know, and the people who are really on the fence are not the partisans who watch broadcast or cable news anyway on, like, 2 p.m. on a Tuesday. So there's not, like, a lot being unveiled or revealed during the process.
Looking at polling that we have done with Ipsos, there is a solid number of Americans who think that the president did something wrong or unethical, but don't actually think he should be removed from office. So there is somewhat of a complicated debate within that segment of the American public. Is that debate playing out in the media? Is that what we're talking about when it comes to kind of the both sides?
Is it
people are still debating what actually happened?
To me, that's such a chicken and egg scenario, because I think that the sentiment of Americans that we get from polling, which is a lot of people think the president did something wrong, it conveys the jadedness and cynicism of the American public right now, where most people think that the president did something really wrong, that he abused power, but they're all kind of like, but we shouldn't remove him from office right now.
In fact, up to 70%, just to get that poll out there, an ABC poll showed 70% thought he did something wrong.
So that is really interesting. That's like if you're a parent saying, like, my kid did something really wrong, but, like, I don't know, I'm not going to ground them because, like, I don't know, the kid's moral character is probably pretty baked in by now. Like, what the hell?
Do you know?
I don't know. Permissive ones or jaded ones, whatever. But you know what I mean? Like, it's sort of
parents
an interest.
Parents who have given up on their children.
Don't walk away with the metaphor too much here, you guys. What I'm trying to say is I think that those polling numbers say something incredibly striking about America. And I think in part it's like, which came first, Americans' jadedness about the impeachment process or, like, the media feeding them the idea, the correct idea, that it's all kind of like a baked-in, cynical, partisan thing? I don't know, because it's true. Like, Mitch McConnell's probably not going to wake up and say, like, well, I'm not going to coordinate with the White House counsel. You know, like, this is not going to happen. And so Schumer can call him, you know, like a, you know, the jury foreman that's in the tank already for the defendant, but That's how it's going to shake out.
I agree with all that. I think Democrats have a real problem of the election and how close it is was always going to be a real issue for them. And I think plays into this idea that a lot of voters have of, yeah, this was bad. Yeah, he did this. But we have an election coming up. I do wonder a little bit, though. I've always been in the, this is not quite as much of a fait accompli as everyone thinks it is. Do I think he's going to get removed? No. But I do wonder a little bit. One, there's still the possibility that new evidence comes out, right? There's a lot of people involved in this that we haven't heard from yet. And there's a lot of reporters in Washington, in New York, around the country digging into this. That has the potential to change the dynamics here. Also, I wonder a little bit if the politics of this will be easier for Democrats once it moves to the Senate.
Where they don't have total control over the process?
Yeah, exactly.
Why is that?
Because I think this is something Claire's written about. You know, Americans, the vast majority of Americans really nowadays start from a position of distrust of institutions, especially with Washington. There's a sense that everything is grimy. All the wheels here are grimy. Right now, Democrats are controlling the wheels in the House, right? When it moves to the Senate, Republicans will be controlling the wheels. And I wonder a little bit if the combination of one, Americans not liking institutions, and two, it's sometimes easier to be on the outside throwing stones than it is to be
driving. So once they
the car.
Start criticizing the Senate process, to your point about whether or not there's still a chance that Trump gets removed from office, you've mentioned this multiple times on the podcast, and I think every time you brought it up, everyone has kind of said no way.
I don't think it's likely he's going to be removed. This is one of those 538.
But it is interesting.
Actually,
I mean, like, is our society not earnest enough? I mean that. Like, are we...
Oh, 100%.
I think 100%. And I think it has to do with the fact that, like, when you pull back and think about American democracy, it's massive population-wise, it's massive geographically, it's extremely prosperous writ large. We don't have a lot of reason in the past, you know, 50 years to think super hard about the day-to-day maintenance of democracy. It's kind of like I think most people sort of think things unfold. It's already been set in the stars and you're just going to watch it on TV. And I think that there is, like, people aren't earnest enough. Everyone does kind of think like it's going to happen the way it happens. Because like in the scenario which you're imagining, Micah, I do think requires a more earnest American public that raises more of a ruckus about this, that it's not just whatever people on MSNBC or like select sort of like blue pockets that will have protests or whatever. You know, like it feels like that possibility only happens if we're like, I don't know, 5 degrees more earnest.
I do think, again, I don't think he's going to be removed. I want to be very clear. I just think that chances are like 8% rather than 2%. But I think to your point, I think there's a lot of people who think Trump did something wrong, but also probably think all these people do like this, right? And that really hurts Democrats' case.
Yeah. Let's continue this conversation in just a minute. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Bespoke Post. This winter, start a new monthly routine that'll upgrade your life and style with a box of awesome from Bespoke Post. Bespoke Post sends guys only the best stuff every month, so whether you're looking to craft your own hard cider or toast perfectly aged winter cocktails, Box of Awesome has you covered. From style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, and outdoor gear, Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right Box of Awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel anytime. Each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. Get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter code POLITICS at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code POLITICS, for 20% off your first box. We're back, and we were looking ahead a little bit to the conclusion of this process, but it's been a little while since we checked in on where public opinion stands today. So, Nate, I know obviously public opinion changed a lot in the beginning days of this story, but as the hearings in the House have played out and as arguments over kind of what the articles would be have moved on, has anything changed in terms of how the public is viewing the process?
Not much has changed, Galen.
But it seems like it's changed a little bit, right? Or maybe people are making too much of small movements.
People are making too much of small movements, Galen. So we've got, as of this morning, we have, let me actually go to only polls that ask about impeachment and removal. 47.6% support, 46.2% don't support. If we zoom back 2 months ago, 47.3% support, 44.7% don't support. So that's pretty minor movement. And there does seem to be variations based on the pollster and the question wording. For some reason, actually, the Fox News poll of all polls, which is a very fair poll, we should say, had some of the worst numbers for President Trump. But yeah, I mean, that's what you see. You see kind of, you know, a lot of these 46 numbers when you take them in average, usually with the support impeachment side just slightly ahead, but if it's only a 2-point gap, then not always by any means. And it surely seems to me like bull punditry when people are just kind of cherry picking the latest poll to tell their story. This is a tailor-made time to wait for the average, and I find it, in fact, very tedious, and there's nothing interesting about it.
What about when it comes to either districts that are represented by a Democrat that voted for Trump or just battleground states in general? Is it worth looking at that polling for judging kind of how America is processing this? Because at the end of the day, you know, we're going to be viewing a lot of the election going forward through the lens of the Electoral College.
Well, it's kind of a second or third order issue, right? The first order thing we want to know is who's going to win the presidency in each state, right? The second order thing is probably looking at Trump's approval rating, which is maybe more important. And there has actually been like a little bit of an uptick in Trump's approval rating. I mean, this is also pretty tenuous, but since you get more approval rating polls, you know, I think it hit like almost 43% in some of our average this weekend, whereas it had been stuck kind of closer to 41, 42 before. That's a little bit of improvement for Trump, actually. No, I think people are getting too cute, right? I mean, first of all, until you have a lot of precision, meaning multiple polls from each state, then you're kind of better off looking at national polls and imputing the trend. And people think they're being very smart and sexy by paying all attention to state polling now. It's 11 months before the election. It's too early to do that.
If you want to be both smart and sexy, pay attention to impeachment in Wisconsin.
Well, sure. In Wisconsin, there have been a bad series of numbers for Democrats, period. I'm not sure it's about impeachment. It's about kind of a problem for Democrats anyway, that Wisconsin might be going the way of Iowa or Ohio. I don't know. That's a problem for Democrats, though, I think, in any eventuality.
This focus group, I think Axios conducted among Michigan Obama Trump voters, was getting a lot of attention. And the thesis of it is essentially that you have these swing voters they're sick of impeachment, they're against it, and therefore impeachment might hurt Democrats come November. Look, beyond everything they just said about sort of zooming in too closely, too far in advance, the other thing I would say is, like, by the time November hits, impeachment is going to be such a distant memory. I just don't buy the idea that voters are going to punish Democrats for, like, focusing on impeachment over other issues when we'll have gone months and months and months and months without Democrats having focused on impeachment.
So what are the other issues?
Well, that's a perfectly fair point. It's not like if not for impeachment, then Congress would be churning out legislation.
Like,
but
like, to me, what's so interesting about the Democrat who became a Republican this weekend is that it was purely over impeachment, right? Like this.
Well, okay. He says.
Yeah, but sure. But the fact that it was like this was the issue, sure, he's probably like a more moderate to conservative Democrat in general. But like, what are the other issues right now? I mean, there's healthcare that people are talking about. But like, I think that's what's so fascinating about American politics lately is it's just like a desolate field of impeachment. And like, what else is there? Like,
well,
what
Democrats, like, and the president as well has been focusing more on other things like trade deal with China or USMCA or, you know, family leave and things like that.
But there are very few things that are actually breaking through. I think that's my point is like, what is so bananas about the current political landscape is that there aren't any real issues. The issues are Trump and the issues are impeachment and the issues are who do you think is the best person to beat Trump in the Democratic primary? We discuss nothing else. There is no other issue.
Well,
and maybe it'll change, but like,
it won't change.
Yeah, between now and Election Day, it will probably become even more zeroed in on just Trump and just the Democrats.
But that's the thing, right? If impeachment were not happening and we were not talking about impeachment, it's not like we'd be having this grand debate about the economy or healthcare or something. We'd still be talking about Trump scandals. There just wouldn't be impeachment.
Well, we'd be talking about the primary, really. I mean, the fact that we're not zeroing in on what's about to happen in Iowa less than 2 months away, right?
Well,
that's what I'm zeroing in on.
We talk plenty about the primary.
Did the impeachment or the 2020 segments get more ratings?
You asked us a while ago when we thought the first podcast would be that we would not do an impeachment segment explicitly from when this scandal began, and actually it was last week.
We didn't do a single impeachment segment. Wow.
Just thought I would note that
dereliction of duty?
I'll tell you one thing, Micah. I'll tell you one thing.
I feel like we're about to get some folksy wisdom from Nate Silver.
Because I saw other people who are campaign reporters tweeting about this. But like, if you get off the impeachment high-speed train, you're totally fine.
Okay.
It's very plausible to like kind of read the headlines about impeachment a few times a week.
What do you mean you're totally fine? What are you talking about?
Who's getting off the high-speed
train?
Nate,
and who's fine?
Voters
I have been by
voters?
Necessity right. focusing on this primary and the model.
But voters or reporters?
But what do you mean you're fine? What does that mean?
In some ways, it gives me a more realistic perspective as a voter.
Okay.
That I'm paying
I'll buy that.
Half or two-thirds attention, right?
I'll buy that,
And if you're paying half or two-thirds attention, then it's not that exciting. Which, exciting is not the metric that's important. If you're a reporter, I'm just saying, like, if you're talking about, like, why isn't public opinion shifting, right? It's because it's mostly confirming beliefs that you already expected, whether they're beliefs because of somewhat rational priors based on the initial reporting of the news or their partisan beliefs or both, right? There is not a lot of discovery in this process. And it's not like Trump is someone who had a squeaky clean image. I guess Obama, except for the Resco stuff.
Obama was pretty squeaky clean.
But this is not someone who has a reputation or Jimmy Carter or something, right? Or the first Bush, who had a reputation for being like squeaky clean, right? This is someone who people kind of assume was up to various types of bad and nefarious acts, who was kind of very publicly requested enemies to research his political rivals, right? So it's like, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's kind of all somewhat priced into people's assessment.
I mean, I think that's apparent at this point.
Right. That goes back to the earnestness, jadedness conversation about America, which is like, if you were to take one line of it, you would say, we're all just sort of like slowly disintegrating our democracy with the acid of our cynicism.
Well, including
or something,
including the media. Because to Nate's point,
correct, yeah,
if you're not really eyeball deep in it, like the when the articles of impeachment were voted out of committee, the cover of the New York Times the next day, I get the paper, was like huge headline, and my first reaction was like, oh, that's a, why is that headline so big? And I was like, oh, of course it's that big. This is a huge deal, right? But here's the here's I guess my question: how much do you guys think it's playing a role that Americans maybe just don't think what Trump did is a big enough sin to be impeached?
I mean, that's apparent, right? If you have in the high 40s of people who yeah. want to remove him and then up towards 70 of people who think he did something wrong. But it comes back to where you set your expectations. If you think that in general politicians do corrupt things,
yeah.
then you would wonder, well, why is this person uniquely getting impeached or removed from office when all of the other things go unpunished? But anyway, I think we're going to, you know, continue to see how this plays out. We'll have a podcast. You know, we will be paying attention. We'll have a podcast when the articles of impeachment are actually voted on.
No, but I just understand what the common voter thinks.
Nate Silver, the common man. Is the lesson of this podcast. But anyway, let's move on to the other topic that we said is, you know, getting attention, which is the Democratic primary. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Hims. According to the American Hair Loss Association, 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35, and approximately 25% of men begin experiencing effects of male pattern baldness before they turn 25. Some men look to procedures to help with hair loss, but these can be costly and painful. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. With Hims, you can find prescription solutions backed by science. Dive into 2020 hair first. Right now, listeners can get started with their first month free. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's forhims.com/538. Not all services or products are available in all 50 states. Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent physician through the Hims platform and are only available if approved by the doctor. Offer valid only if prescribed. 3-month minimum subscription required. Additional restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information while supplies last. Remember, that's 4hims.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems with commercial-grade businesses. The Fortune 100 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit them at ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. We're back, and we've talked plenty about who voters are supporting as their first choice, but it's worth taking a closer look at who voters say their second choices are. It'll matter as candidates drop out and in caucuses where voters can support someone else if their candidate doesn't meet the 15% threshold to get delegates. And we can dig into the details a little bit more, but according to a recent Morning Consult poll, the picture looks something like this. Biden supporters' most preferred second choice is Sanders. Sanders supporters' second choice is Warren, with Biden close behind. Warren supporters' second choice is Sanders. And Buttigieg supporters are split between Warren and Biden for their primary second choice. Nate, as we have seen candidates drop out or voters change preferences, is it clear whether or not people are actually moving to what they tell pollsters is their second choice? Like when Harris dropped out, did her supporters actually go to their second choice? Is it that kind of straightforward when it comes to second choice polling?
Okay, first of all, let me throw something out there. Lanes are underrated. Everyone thinks lanes are overrated. Lanes are underrated.
Hot take.
And because we've actually studied this a lot. I've been looking at this a lot, both in this election and in historical elections. So let me give you an example, right? In The Economist, they ask, who are you also considering, which is more robust in part because it looks at all the candidates and not just your top choice, right? So among Pete Buttigieg supporters, more Pete Buttigieg supporters are considering Amy Klobuchar than Bernie Sanders. which is amazing because Sanders is at 17% overall and she's at 3, right? So that's a sign that actually there is some connective tissue between Buttigieg and Klobuchar that they are far more likely to consider her than they would be from chance alone. So even would be that, okay, if 20% of the electorate supports Bernie, that every candidate's second choice supporters go 20% for Bernie, minus the fact that they can't pick their own candidate, so goes up. Anyway, it's a little complicated, right? But that's the basic idea, right? Instead, you see correlations. We've actually tried to go back and estimate these in the past where, like, you can probably have, if you have two candidates who are really similar, there's maybe 50% more voters considering them jointly than there would be otherwise. If they're really dissimilar, I think one example from the past is, like, there were probably no people who were, like, Jeb Bush / Ben Carson undecided voters 4 years ago.
Wait a second. But so Nate, your main point is basically when looking at these second choice numbers, just adjust for how the candidates are doing overall.
I mean, think about if you actually have to model where would second choice support be, right? And the first approximation is just to say, okay, assume that there is no correlation between the candidates, right? It's divided evenly relative to the, you know, so again, it's okay. So let's say that like I am a Cory Booker supporter, Cory Booker drops out, right? And Biden is 26% in the national polls. That means there's a 26% chance I go to Biden, 18% to Sanders, right, whatever else, down the line with the polls, right? The way we handle it in the model, still being worked on the model, right, is there's a multiplier, in essence, between every pair of two candidates based on how similar they are on several kind of ideological and other dimensions, right? And empirically, that actually does a better job of predicting where support goes when a candidate drops out, as well as other things.
Can I ask just very broadly, so looking at all of this second choice data or who people are considering, who is doing well in terms of second choice support?
I think Warren, right?
Warren, but it's a little bit of a mixed bag because in general, the vectors run both ways. If a lot of people are considering you as a second choice, it also means that your voters also have a lot of second choices. And we've seen that one problem that Warren has, although she's universally maybe the most acceptable candidate, lots of her voters are fine with some combination of Bernie, Buttigieg, Biden, Klobuchar, Harris.
So it's not necessarily the strongest level of support you would want.
I think the way to think about it is like think about two typologies of candidates, right? One candidate is smack dab in the middle of all the other candidates, and they are candidates who try to unify the party, who almost everyone would find acceptable, who probably have appeal to a fair number of different demographic groups, right? And who are not too far to one extreme or another on left, right, or inside or outside or whatever spectrum you want to come up with, right? And then you have candidates who are kind of a island unto themselves, right? An example might be one of the Pauls, Ron Paul or Rand Paul, especially Ron Paul in the, what was it, 208 and 2012 primaries, right? Where like he is kind of obviously marching to his own drummer in terms of being a true libertarian, very much an outsider, right? Appeals to types of voters who might not vote in the primary otherwise. Those types of candidates tend to have, like you can call them factional candidates if you want, right? Tend to have fairly steady support. The candidates who are trying to be a candidate for everyone are very boom and bust, right? As you've seen with Kamala Harris, for example, as you've seen a little bit with Elizabeth Warren, their numbers have moved around, right? In this primary, I mean, none of the candidates really is in like the Rand Paul territory, right? But Biden and Bernie in our metric actually are a little bit more, have a little bit more space to themselves than the other candidates, the other major candidates, I should say, right? Certainly than Warren and Buttigieg kind of overlap, right? And their support has been much steadier. That's kind of what would actually be predicted from the historical record, right? Is that the more space you have to yourself, then the lower your volatility. And you tend not to, you know, on the one hand, you tend not to get a big bounce, as big a bounce if you win a state. On the other hand, you won't be hurt as much if something bad happens. So you've seen that, like, there are a lot of Bernie supporters for whom Bernie is the only choice, and a lot of Biden supporters for whom Biden is the only choice. And I'm looking at the Economist numbers that confirm you can get to this conclusion in multiple ways, right? And so I think people thought, oh, it's an advantage to be people's second choice. After looking at this data, we also look, by the way, historically at, like, polls that ask voters, who's your second choice? And do candidates who often come up with, yeah, you're the second choice in polls tend to perform better over time? The answer is, as far as we can tell, not really, right? Marco Rubio was a lot of people's second choice. Donald Trump was very few people's. That did not seem to help Rubio or hurt Trump very much in 2016.
Well, And that seems like a really good caution that, like, being acceptable to a broad swath of the party is about potential. You have to actualize your potential. But, Nate, right now, Sanders has a small lead over Warren in national polls. But let's say they were even. In terms of chances of winning the nomination, would you rather be Sanders or would you rather be Warren? In other words, would you rather have a kind of consistent, loyal support, which has the benefits you enumerated, or would you rather be Warren, who's been a little boomer bust, but half the party is considering voting for her, according to that Economist data, tied with Biden for first? No one else is even really close.
So Warren has higher upside, right? You know, but Bernie might be in a position where he has enough support where he can start to win primaries and caucuses, and then even with a smallish bounce, then that could be pretty durable potentially. I think if you're, you know, I mean, it depends, right? If you're at 30%, then
you'd rather be Sanders.
You want low volatility, right? Yep. If you're at 17, 18, 20, 15, 14, whatever numbers they've been at over the past few months off and on, then you probably want a little bit higher volatility. That is maybe like a negative for Sanders, but it is like very much like a two-sided coin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a real benefit to being people's first choice.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a really great candidate and you're, you know, you're both a few passionate voters' first choice and you're a lot of people's second choice. There's no one like that in the primary this year.
Well, the other way to just think about the Warren second choice numbers is there's a lot of voters right now who like Warren but are not listing her as their first choice, which makes you sort of wonder what's going on there.
Yeah, and maybe it could be something having to do with electability or her gender, right, or a lot of things, right? But it's not necessarily like, okay, if you come to me and you say, I'm looking for a job in a field that, let's say, is a difficult field to break into or that maybe you don't have traditional credentials for, right? Or you're a member of a group that's discriminated against historically, right, in that field. And you say, I have gotten a lot of first-round interviews and some second-round interviews, just not any job offers yet. Is that a bearish fact or a bullish fact?
Yeah.
It's actually kind of ambiguous.
That's right? A great analogy, actually.
Yeah.
So Nate's been making the case that lanes are real in the Democratic primary and that maybe we should pay more attention to them. Are the lanes based on personal characteristics and personality or actual ideology and policy?
The concept of lanes has kind of traditionally been ideological. And I think the lane that we end up talking the most about has been the moderate one because it was so uncrowded for such a long time. And now obviously Biden and Buttigieg are kind of fighting over that. But this kind of goes back to, I mean, voters, I think, I always put it as, it's political pheromones. You like the person who you think kind of gets it, and usually that's stylistic. In this particular primary, it's who you think can beat Trump or who you think a certain kind of voter will vote for. So it's not surprising to me that Biden and Sanders supporters like the other candidates, right? The other's candidate. You know, Sanders people might like Biden and Biden people might like Sanders. And that has a lot to do with the fact that probably that those guys have a white male identity that could be seen as a safe bet, right? So I think we're kind of seeing a lot of that. Or, you know, a Warren Buttigieg thing. I mean, I think it's no surprise that Buttigieg is kind of trying to press against her as the rival, his main rival in the campaign, right? He's saying, listen, Warren voters, like, yeah, I'm a little more moderate than Elizabeth Warren, but I'm more likely to win, right? It's the idea of appealing to those like establishment types. So I think while we classically talk about lanes as ideological, in this primary, there's sort of an interesting, I guess I would, there's almost like two factors. It's like the candidate's ideology and then the candidate's self-presentation, which is really hard to parse out. I think that makes for a complicated scale.
No, yeah, maybe the way to put it is like ideological lanes are overrated, but pheromone identity lanes are underrated.
I mean, overrated relative to what? I mean, we actually have to come up with a way to mathematically kind of conceive of this problem for the model, right? And so we kind of came up with the fact that there are basically four dimensions, of which probably only three of which are relevant this year, right? So you have a left versus right dimension on economics. You have a liberal versus center or conservative dimension on social policy. in this election, those two can kind of be compressed, right? You don't really have a lot of candidates who are maybe Bloomberg or something, right? Who are like fiscally conservative but socially liberal, yeah. And even he's not that social liberal.
I said right? One ideological left-right for this election.
So for this podcast, yeah. One is ideological left-right. A second one is pro or anti-establishment or insider outsider. It's kind of one of the classic like kind of framings throughout all the primaries in history, right? And the third is what I call kind of highbrow, middle brow, you could say highbrow populist, right? It can loosely be approximated by, is your coalition dominated by kind of college-oriented people? And does it have a very kind of media-focused strategy, or is it more populist? And you're kind of striking themes of us against the elites, right? And these are interesting, right? Because Joe Biden is someone who is actually probably more on the middle brow dimension, even though he's clearly an insider, right? He's saying, hey, look, I mean, he literally says, like, I'm super experienced. I've been doing this for a long time. That's why you should vote for me, right? Pete Buttigieg is kind of an outsider, although he's a complicated case because he was, like, ran for DNC chair and stuff like that, right? But kind of outsider-ish, but very, very highbrow, right? Yeah. Very college-educated support, as is Warren. And so if you look at that, then you actually kind of get patterns that match what we see in the data, right? So there's very little overlap between... Wait,
which is more important, though, between the highbrow, lowbrow, establishment, outsider, and the right-left in terms of policy,
ideology? I would say it's highbrow, lowbrow. Those being Nate's words, not mine.
I mean, that's, in Democratic primary, too, then you kind of also have a dimension of race. But Biden and Bernie have more, to some extent Bernie, have more diverse support than the other candidates, right? Oh, that's just kind of close between Bernie and Warren. So having a broad base of support also tends to mean that you have a more racially diverse base of support in the Democratic Party. I don't know which one you'd prioritize. I mean, clearly education's become a key divide for everything in the party. But like, if you look at Bernie and Buttigieg, I mean, their supporters clearly do not like one another, right? And if you look at the numbers, it's economist data, there are very few overlaps between those two, that pair of candidates. And they're opposite along every dimension, right? Bernie is liberal, Buttigieg is moderate-ish, right? Bernie is kind of middle brow, Buttigieg is definitely appealing toward upper middle brow people at least.
So what you said, Nate, about the insider, outsider, or like establishment, anti-establishment, is really like such a classic rubric and such a good way to understand so much in politics. Is it sort of not playing as big a role in the Democratic primary this year?
Insider-outsider?
Yeah, insider-outsider.
I don't know. That's a good question. But it's like technically Warren has only been in politics for like 10 years, but she's seen as a...
Outsider.
Yeah, well... But she's accepted by, she's liked by establishment voters who wouldn't necessarily say that they were seeking an outsider candidate.
Is it also harder to play outsider politics when the party isn't backing someone? Like there's, for example, no Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders 2016 campaign.
There's also been this interesting painting of Buttigieg as an insider, even though his resume says outsider, and it's because, Buttigieg has big donors and Buttigieg has been kind of like raring to go to do this for years. Like there's like, and I think it mostly comes down to like the shift to the center and the big donor, the still taking big donors. And that kind of makes it like, oh, well, like maybe you're more of like an old school, old money yeah. Democrat than you actually are. So maybe it's more, maybe insider outsider has been replaced by like, to use extremely loaded language, like, the corporate Democrats versus yeah. the small money. Like it's almost like populist versus this traditional. I don't know, like traditional establishment. I can't quite find the words right now.
The other reason maybe that sort of dynamic is playing less of a role in the primary this year, if I'm right that it is playing less of a role, is maybe because really the only unalloyed insider in the campaign is Biden. We have candidates like Warren who have some insider credentials,
right,
but is somewhat of a populist, is a woman. Buttigieg, some insider credentials, is super young, is jumping the line, right? Even candidates like Cory Booker, who have a lot of insider credentials, is black, which in some ways makes him an outsider with a white political establishment.
Well, we saw Hillary Clinton kind of try to dance this dance in 2016.
Not people, well, yeah.
People would say, well, you're a consummate insider. And she would say, well, I'm a woman, which has made me an outsider my whole life.
Which is a legitimate point.
Yeah. So I think that it's in some ways like that, not that the framework is meaningless anymore, but that the new divide has become the new insider-outsider is populist versus establishment.
And just more
populist
identity.
Populist versus traditional.
I think it's also worth noting that outsiderism has always been a performance, right? I mean, like when you have Howard Dean waging his outsider campaign as a governor, you have Reagan waging his outsider campaign as the governor of the largest state in the union. You know, it's always been not necessarily what your credentials are versus the kind of campaign that you run and the language you use to make your point. And on top of that, they're all running against Donald Trump, who they're never going to beat when it comes to outsider cred.
That's what I was about to say, is I wonder how much Trump plays a role in this, too, of sort of like just scrambling that whole dynamic. Because he's like, in a lot of ways, the ultimate outsider in the ultimate insider job. He's the incumbent president, right? So it just kind of screws up the whole dynamic.
All right. So in conclusion, there are lanes. Second choices matter sometimes, but it's not necessarily good to have a lot of voters' second choice.
Just I think just to give people maybe some more useful advice on the second choice, I think Nate was saying that the idea of second choice matters and matches up somewhat with those lanes. But Nate, Dave Peterson wrote a piece for our site looking at panel survey data of second choices in Iowa and found basically that like they're not rock solid. But, you know, like half of them hold true over time, which seems like a pretty decent kind of rubric.
So in states where you actually have some type of reallocation of votes, so in the Iowa caucus, if your candidate does not have 15% in your caucus site, you literally have to go line up with someone else, right?
And you don't have to. You can.
You can if you
You can
like.
Go home.
You can go home. Or you can stick. You can just like file your protest vote.
You
and not
don't
get
have
any
to go
delegates
home, but
for
you can't vote for Amy Klobuchar if she doesn't have 15%. But like, so it is relevant though in those states to figure out kind of who are the candidates who might have somewhere between, you know, 0 and 15% support, and where might their supporters go.
We should do that article.
So like, you know, in a world where the numbers now are kind of reversed, and Bernie is at 11% and Warren's at 17%. I mean, there is evidence that like a lot of Bernie supporters, if they can't get Bernie, wouldn't be thrilled, but would much prefer Warren to their third choice, right? And so that dynamic is actually like would be very good for Warren. The reverse, though, where she's below 15%, that might be good for – and her second choice are more split, right? There's certainly some Sanders, but there's some Buttigieg. There's a little bit of Biden. There's a little – Klobuchar, and so char. Anyway, I've obviously been spending too much time on this, but the point is that, like, yeah, in Iowa, where you literally have to act on your second choice or can act on your second choice, then it's a different ballgame.
All right, let's leave it there. But before we go, we have some news, some housekeeping. We have a live show in DC on January 16th. So if you want to come see this live in action, go to 538.com/live for details and tickets. Should be a fun time. Also, we are recording a podcast to play over the holidays where we're going to answer a bunch of your questions. It's going to be like Santa's mailbag kind of thing. So if you have any questions that you've been dying to hear us answer, send us an email or tweet at us, podcasts@538.com, and we'll try to answer some of your questions. But that's it for now. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thanks, Micah.
You're welcome.
My name is Galen Druk. Kevin Ryder is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.